From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, two new movies in theaters for the holidays. First, we talk with Luke Wilson, one of the stars of The Family Stone, a comedy about a Christmas family reunion that also stars Diane Keaton and Sarah Jessica Parker. A lot of Wilson's work is involved with family. He acted with his brother Owen Wilson in the films Bottle Rocket and The Royal Tenenbaums. The new film The Producers is adapted from Mel Brooks' Broadway hit. We'll talk with Susan Stroman, the director and choreographer of both, and we'll hear some songs from the film. And book critic Maureen Corrigan has her list of the best books of 2005. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Luke Wilson, is one of the stars of the new film, The Family Stone. He made his film debut with his brother, Owen Wilson, in the independent film Bottle Rocket, which was directed by their friend, Wes Anderson, who also directed them in The Royal Tenenbaums. Luke Wilson's other movies include Old School, Charlie's Angels, and Legally Blonde. The Family Stone is a comic story set at Christmas as the adult children of the Stone family return to their parents' home in New England. The oldest son brings his girlfriend, played by Sarah Jessica Parker. She's tightly wound and controlling. As soon as she meets the family, she's convinced they hate her. And she's right. After she's managed to alienate the parents, two sisters, and the deaf gay brother, she leaves the house in embarrassment. Her boyfriend's other brother, played by Luke Wilson, takes her to a bar in the hopes of calming her down.
I am not a bad person.
You're a total mess. Look at you.
I am?
I mean that in the best possible sense, of course. You know that.
I do? I love the gays! Gay people!
They know that.
Then why? I took her to the nicest restaurant I know, and she didn't say a word to me. Not one word. All evening. But I tried. And I try, and I would have slept on the couch.
Maybe you should stop. Stop. Stop trying. You know, it's exhausting. Trying to keep that lid screwed on so tight. Relax.
Luke Wilson, welcome to Fresh Air. In much of The Family Stone, you're kind of like hanging back, observing everybody be crazy. So it must be an interesting part to have, because so much of your role is observing people as we observe you observing them.
Right. You know, I guess the character I play, Ben Stone, seems so different from the rest of the family because they're just kind of so straight-laced. I never even really thought of him that way. And just being on the set day to day and being around people like, Diane Keaton and Craig T. Nelson, you just get to talking so much. It's like one minute you're having a conversation, and the next minute you're doing a scene. And I never really, felt the difference between, doing the scene or just hanging around with him. I was enjoying both, but then... you see the finished product, and it's all been cut together so that everybody seems a certain way. But it's almost as if I wasn't aware of it while we were doing it.
Is Diane Keaton somebody you grew up watching?
Yeah. I can just remember my Aunt Sheila being a big fan of hers and, I can remember going to the theater to see Looking for Mr. Goodbar, for instance. And I was pretty young to see that, thinking back. I don't know that I'd take my nephew to that nowadays, but
learn a thing or two about dating.
Yeah, dating in New York in the 70s. and then of course Annie Hall and things like that, and she's one of those people where it's I don't know how they manage to get away with it, but certain people that are kind of come around in the 60s and 70s, like her and Jack Nicholson, and they don't seem to do TV press, so whenever you see them, it seems for the most part you see them on screen, or people like Warren Beatty, that was interesting to be around her.
You have two older brothers. One of them is Owen Wilson, who you co-starred with in Bottle Rocket and in The Royal Tenenbaums, and both of which were directed by Wes Anderson, and of course he's in a film that you just wrote and directed that you also star in that's coming out in February. So who started acting first, Owen, your older brother, or you?
I think probably Owen started acting first back in school. I mean, we were never big theater guys, but I think we both did plays here and there. And we both got into the in the movie business at the same time, you know, doing the film Bottle Rocket. But as kids, we lived on the street called Farquhar, and my dad had this thing he called the Farquhar Players, where it was me and Owen and my brother Andrew, and we just kind of had these little skits that we'd do for him and his friends after dinner. And they were all kind of making fun of him, oddly enough, but he really got a kick out of them. So that's probably our kind of our first acting stuff, you know, where we were, one of us would play our dad, one of us would play our mom, one would play, you know, the guy at the barbecue joint that didn't understand my dad's Boston accent. So, yeah, that's probably when we started.
What were some of the qualities you'd make fun of your father for?
His temper. I don't know if you can call that a quality. No, but, yeah, we were just kind of kidding around about his temper and him having, even as kids we had picked up that he has a very thick Boston accent. We grew up in Dallas, and you'd get a lot of people that had said, I didn't catch that. What'd you say again? You know, that kind of thing. And that would always kind of hit our funny bone a little bit.
Now, you were, like, on sports teams in school before acting, right?
Right.
And you're one of several actors who I've talked to over the years who started in sports and ended up in acting, and yet, for some reason, to me, they seem like really like different styles. You know, the acting versus athletics. Was it a big switch for you to move from one to another, and to move from one group of people to the other?
Not at all. And I think about it, you know, really on every job, the fact, you know, how glad I am that I played sports growing up. I played football and I ran track. And because you really, you know, I mean, it's cliched stuff, but you learn how to work on a team. And, you know, I'll see somebody walk on a movie set and, you know, kind of be dismissive of certain people that are working on, you know, certain jobs on the crew. And it'll just kind of make me think, God, how can they not get that, you know, each person does play an important part in getting the movie made, yet there are people like that. But I also just think it helps with things like timing. And, you know, it's like if you play on a football team, you know that the, like, the left tackle is just as important as the quarterback, even though he might get all the glory.
Now, your father headed a PBS station in... In Dallas, was it?
In Dallas, I think my dad's name is Robert Wilson, and he, through a man named Ralph Rogers, my dad became the head of Channel 13 in Dallas, I think, from maybe 68 to 76, or I might have those years off. But, yeah, that was a great time. And just remember, you know, being around so many interesting people, and that would have been our first time to kind of be around, you know, a film studio, just where they had a news hour there, and that was actually where Jim Lehrer got his start. He was a political writer at the Dallas Times Herald, which is now defunct, but that was the first place that he went on the air. And yeah, it was just a really interesting mix of people down there, just the guys building the sets and the camera guys, and always the kind of group of people that were, like, you know, kind of especially nice to kids. It wasn't like walking in some office building. These were always guys that kind of made you feel welcome.
Now, your mother's a photographer who did a book about Richard Avedon's photographs, and she did a gallery show of photographs of her sons, you, Owen, and Andrew. I guess from childhood up through your work in the movies. Do you feel like you learned anything about movie making from seeing things through her eyes? You know, did she talk to you about, when you went to the movies with her, did she talk to you about, you know, angles and shots and that kind of thing?
Yeah, well, I definitely think I learned to, it helped, I know that it helps me to feel comfortable with a camera kind of close to my face, or to have somebody pointing a camera, and I know that I'm conscious of it, and in a good way. And I think that definitely comes from her. And also, I would learn about light from her, and when the best time of day to shoot, and And you learn working in the movies, there's a time called magic hour where it's the last hour of the day, and the light is the best, where you don't even actually need to use artificial light. But magic hour is good and bad. It is beautiful, but you also get, things get crazy in terms of everyone's rushing around and you're trying to get the shot, and then the last shots invariably are too dark, but you've just tried to get them. And it's always kind of sad when the light runs out. But yeah, I definitely think it ties into the movie business, having had her as being a photographer and just always taking pictures, and then being around her and Avedon and seeing him at work. But no, she didn't. I went to the movies more with my dad, and he'd take us to anything, and whether it was R or PG, and he was just a big movie fan, and that really affected me because he took me to some great stuff that, I can remember going to see The Man Who Would Be King with him, and then a movie called Thief, which was Michael Mann's first movie, and those just made a huge impression on me. And I started out just loving to watch them, and then as I got, older, maybe around 12 or 14, started just trying to read about them, and the school I went to got the magazine Film Comment.
It must have been an interesting school if they subscribed to Film Comment.
Yeah, it was a good school. I don't know why they did. But it was great that they had it. Everybody. Sports Illustrated was always out, but Film Comment was always right there on the rack, ready to be read. Growing up in Texas, I would have to kind of hide the fact that I had absolutely no interest in the sports page.
My guest is Luke Wilson. He co-stars in the new film, The Family Stone. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Luke Wilson, and he's now starring in the new movie, The Family Stone. It's Wes Anderson, who directed you and your brother Owen in Bottle Rocket and The Royal Tenenbaums, he's said that he used to really want to be part of your family. Did you understand that did you know that when you were younger? And did you understand that... That desire that he had.
I think Wes says that kind of more as a joke and maybe trying to pay a compliment to our parents. I don't think he would necessarily want to have been brothers with me or Owen or Andrew, but no, he just, my folks always really loved Wes and loved being around him and could just, we'd had some kind of wild, rough-hewn friends, and then here comes this guy that kind of wears tweed jackets and has a Truffaut book under his arm, and they thought, this is the kind of boy that we wish the boys would hang around with. So Wes was always very welcome at our house, and I think he just kind of liked being around, and we just had the same interests, where we might be different guys, just in terms of having played sports and things like that. We were really big movie lovers, and Wes was just always made to feel comfortable at the house and at my dad's office.
In the film The Royal Tenenbaums, you play a kind of former tennis star who is very depressed much of the time, and you're in love with your adopted sister Margot, who's played by Gwyneth Paltrow. I want to play a short scene, and this is a scene on a roof between you and Gene Hackman, who plays your scoundrel father, and he's just found out that you've been in love with your adopted sister, Margot.
Yeah.
Margot Tenenbaum?
Yeah.
Well, since when?
Since always.
Does she know?
Uh-huh.
Well, what does she feel about that?
I think she feels confused.
Well, I can understand that. It's probably illegal.
I don't think so. We're not related by blood.
That's true. Still frowned upon. But then what isn't these days, right? I don't know. Maybe it works. Why not? What the hell? You love each other. Nobody knows what's going to happen, so... You know something? Don't listen to me. I never understood her myself. I never understood any of us. I wish I could tell you what to do, but I just can't.
That's okay.
No, it's not. You still consider me your father?
Sure I do.
I wish I had more to offer in that department.
I know you do, Pop.
That's a scene from The Royal Tenenbaums with my guest, Luke Wilson, and Gene Hackman. I know if I were an actor, I'd really want to do scenes with Gene Hackman. He's really so terrific. What do you get working opposite him in a scene? Like, what's it like to work with somebody who is as good and as subtle as he is?
Well, for me, it was just kind of watching him on the set. He never left the set. He always kind of had the script in his hand. And he was, you know, kept to himself while at the same time being friendly. But he just worked very hard. And I can remember one time we were doing this. It would make me, you know, focus, you know, much more than, say, I was working with Owen or something. But one day I kind of... we were doing a scene in an elevator where we had to do it in an actual elevator, and I just kind of got the line wrong twice in a row, and he just looked back at me with this glance that shivered me to the bone. And needless to say, I nailed it on the next take. But yeah, that was what I learned just from being around him. And he's probably my favorite actor, and that's been the best part of my being in the movie so far, is getting the chance to work with him. There's nobody like him, and he's just great. You can't beat him.
You wrote, directed, and star in a new film that's scheduled to start opening in February. It's called The Wendell Baker Story, and you play a con man who's deluded himself into thinking that he's a great businessman. And his business is making fake ID cards for Mexicans who are working illegally in the United States, right across the border. And this film is a comedy, and he goes on to get busted, spend time in prison, lose his girlfriend, and all kinds of complications ensue. What made you think about this as a subject, about this guy as a character?
Growing up in Texas, it's one of those things. Sometimes you kind of feel that, you know, there's an element of people saying, "Now, oh, how do we get these borders closed? How do we keep these people from, you know, coming over here?" And then you'll get so many of the people that, you know, a lot of the construction that goes on in Texas, you know, the highways and all these homes are the very people that they're complaining about being there, and probably the same people that are hiring them and paying lower wages. So I don't know. I just like the idea of a guy that was a character that thought, you know, he really thought of himself. Wendell Baker calls his Airstream that he uses as his office the Ellis Island of the Southwest, where he just thinks these are the people that are like kind of the backbone of the country. And he thinks he's doing a service to the country by you know, making them official citizens while kind of cutting corners.
And I want to play a short scene, and this is when he's in the trailer that he uses for his office. And there's pictures of a lot of Latino stars on the wall, and he points to each of them and talks about how...
he claims that they're his clients.
He claims that they're his clients, exactly. So here's that scene, and my guest, Luke Wilson, is in the role.
Let me talk to some of y'all about some of my past clients. Jimmy Smits. I mean, I'm straight, but the guy smolders. Never quite broke through like I hoped. Fernando Valenzuela. Good guy, great arm, not the biggest advocate of physical conditioning. Ultimately, I think it hurt his longevity. I get out of a relationship with Salma Hayek, the frying pan, and go right into the fire. Jenny Lopez, nice girl, dated her briefly. said some stuff about me around town. I hold no ill will. Chi-Chi Rodriguez calls me, says, Wendell, I'm having trouble with my game. I watch him swing a couple times, and I give him one note. Fire the knees. Fire him right at the flagstick. Next week, he wins the Greater Hartford Senior Open. And all this business, slaying the dragon, he saw me do it on the 12th hole of Laredo Country Club in 1978.
That's Luke Wilson in a scene from his forthcoming film, The Wendell Baker Story. You wrote a role for your brother, Owen Wilson. What was it like for you to direct your brother?
Well, it was one of those things where it wasn't, I wouldn't even really call it directing. It was more, he brought so many funny lines to it, it would just kind of make me think of other stuff. It was just more a case of, why don't you try this? And it was really fun to have him on the set, and it was one of those things where, you know, if it weren't for him being in the movie, you know, wouldn't have been able to get the money for the movie. So he's the, you know, probably one of the main reasons we were able to get the movie made. So it was just really fun to have him on the set playing a part then, too, so he could really be a part of it across the line.
Well, Luke Wilson, thank you so much. Happy holidays.
Thank you very much for having me, and I really enjoy the show, and I'm really glad to have been on, so thanks very much.
Luke Wilson stars in the new film, The Family Stone. His film, The Wendell Baker Story, which co-stars his brother Owen and was co-directed by his other brother, Andrew, premieres in Texas this February, then will roll out nationally. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Anne Bronte's neglected novel, Agnes Grey, in the Barnes & Noble Classic Series, in stores and online. From the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org. And from the Charles Stuart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, it's springtime for Hitler again. We'll talk with Susan Stroman, director and choreographer of the Broadway hit The Producers and the new movie adaptation, and critic Maureen Corrigan has her list of the best books of the year.
Leo and Max, up off our backs, back on the great wide way. Leo and Max, back on our tracks, we're back on top to stay. So when we take your money, never fear, we'll knock Broadway right on its ear. The cast is great, the script is swell, but this one telling you, sirs, it's just no go, you've got no show without the producers. We'll never quit. Hit after hit.
The Producers, Leo and Max.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Hitler is singing and dancing again in the new movie adaptation of Mel Brooks's hit Broadway musical, The Producers. The musical was an adaptation of Brooks's 1968 film. The show won 12 Tonys, more than any show in Broadway history. It was directed and choreographed by my guest Susan Stroman, who performed the same duties for the new film. Her other Broadway credits include Oklahoma, The Music Man, and Crazy for You. In the new movie, The Producers, Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick once again star as two producers who figure out a scam to make a fortune. All they need to do is find the worst play ever written, then convince a group of investors to back it. When this awful show closes on opening night, and they're certain it will, the producers can run off to Rio with the rest of the investors' money. The absolute worst play they find is a musical called Springtime for Hitler, a surefire flop because of production numbers like this. Here's Gary Beach from the soundtrack of the new movie.
I was just a paper hanger, no one more obscure. Got a phone call from the Reichstag, told me I was Führer. Germany was blue, oh, 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 what to do? Hitched up my pants and conquered France. Now Deutschland's smiling through. Mermen, don't you know? We are crossing borders. The new world order is here. Make a great big smile. Everyone sing Heil to me. Wonderful me. And now it's
springtime for him.
Susan Stroman, welcome to Fresh Air. How did you become involved with the producers in the first place?
Well, I got a call. I was rehearsing A Christmas Carol down at Madison Square Garden, and I got a call saying that Mel Brooks wants to meet you. And I thought, all right, well, maybe next Thursday. And then the call came back, said, no, he needs to meet you tonight right away. So I thought, oh, my gosh. I left rehearsal, and I went home, and so excited about meeting him because I knew everything about him. I knew the 2,000-year-old man. I knew every movie he had ever made. So I was a huge fan, and I loved his comedy. So I was very excited and nervous, and there was a knock on the door, and I opened the door, and there he was, this legend, my hero. But instead of saying hello, he launched into full voice the song That Face, which is in the movie and opens Act Two on Broadway. But he started to sing, and then he went right past me, right down my hallway, singing full out, got up on top of my sofa, finished the song, and then looked down at me and said, hello, I'm Mel Brooks. And I thought to myself, well, you know, whatever happens with this show, it'll end up being the greatest adventure. And in fact, it's ended up being one of the greatest adventures of my life. So I think everybody has a story about when they first meet Mel. That certainly is a story that I'll never forget.
Now, is that what it's like to work with Mel Brooks, that he's doing song and dances and you know, or things more direct when you're working together?
Well, the thing is, you know, Mel was meant to write a musical, because when you think about all his movies, he really pays homage to musical movies. For example, he has Frankenstein's monster dancing and putting on the Ritz, and he and Anne dance Sweet Georgia Brown in To Be or Not to Be. And even he has Count Basie's band on the desert in Blazing Saddles.
Let's not forget Jews in Space.
Yes, Jews in Space, absolutely. So there is a nod to the musical in everything he's ever done. So he was really meant to write a musical. He loves singing and dancing, and he loves those old movies. I mean, he's a kindred spirit, really, because we are able to speak about Top Hat and Swing Time and Roberta and all, you know, really, really classic movies, famous musical movies. We both love them. So the fact that now he has written this musical that had, you know, broke box office records and awards, and is pretty fantastic.
No, one of the numbers that you added for the show and is also in the movie is a number in which is what Max Bialystock, this washed-up producer, does to get money to back his shows, which inevitably flop, is he seduces elderly women, and in return they write him checks because they're so grateful for his attentions. So there's a production number in which all of these older women that he's seduced do a song and dance number on their walkers.
Yes.
Whose idea was it to do a song and dance number on walkers, which you could argue is in pretty bad taste, not quite up there with singing and dancing Nazis, but still, you know.
Well, when we started working on the number and that Max was going to somehow collect all these checks, in the theater it can be done more abstractly rather than showing a million front doors or a million sofas where he's taking the checks. So it was done in dance. And since I had immersed myself into the world of Mel Brooks, what could be funnier than one little old lady with a walker, but 20 little old ladies with walkers? And and then to add to that, putting taps on the ends of the walkers. So it seemed that if Max Bialystock was making these little old ladies so happy that they would dance with joy, and they would dance with joy with their walkers, and that would make it very percussive, very rhythmic. And in fact, it has almost a tribal feel to it in a happy way. And at the end of the number, they all hand Max a check, all made out to Cash.
Which he says is the name of his new show.
Yes. Yes, he says to invest in his show called Cash. And they say that's a funny name for a play. And he says, yes, so is the Iceman Cometh.
Well, why don't we hear the music that goes along with this this dance on walkers that we're talking about. And it's called Along Came Bialy.
They were helpless. They were hopeless. Then along came Bialy. They were joyless, they were boyless. Then along came Bialy. They're my angels, I'm their devil, and I keep those embers aglow. When I woo 'em, I can't lose 'em, 'cause I cast my spell and they start yelling fire down below. So romantic, they were frantic, then their prayers were heard up above. Heaven sent them their Bialy. I'm the celebration of love.
Who is it? Who is it?
It's Max Bialystock.
Oh!
This music from the soundtrack of The Producers, my guest Susan Stroman, directed and choreographed both the Broadway show and the new musical adaptation. In the Larry David HBO series Curb Your Enthusiasm last season, Mel Brooks was staging a West Coast production of The Producers, and he cast Larry David in the lead role. And of course, this is preposterous since Larry David can't sing and he can't dance. Of course, in the final episode, we find out that the reason why Mel Brooks did it, well, why don't you explain?
Okay. Yes. Larry David wrote a wonderful script about the idea that Mel had it with the producers because it was all-consuming. So he would come up with a plan to close it by putting in the worst Max Bialystock he could find. And the worst Max Bialystock would be Larry David. So within this plot, he goes to meet Larry David and talks him into playing Max Bialystock. And he learns the part. He ends up playing Max Bialystock against David Schwimmer. And what happens, though, is he is the worst Max Bialystock. He goes up on his lines on the stage, but then launches into his own stand-up comedy routine as a means to an end, as a means to sort of get on with it, and to satisfy the audience. And, of course, it becomes a big hit and a big smash. So not unlike the original 1968 screenplay where Max Bialystock was looking for the worst show ever written, in this particular plot, Mel Brooks was looking for the worst Max Bialystock. I thought it was wonderfully written. It was all Larry David's idea. And In fact, it was the last time that Mel and Ann were on film. So it was wonderful that it happened.
It was Larry David's idea. I always assumed it was Mel Brooks's.
No, it's Larry. Larry approached Mel.
I should have figured that. And Mel Mel Brooks went for it.
Oh, yeah. I think because he loved the storyline so much. And the whole idea is so funny because Larry David wanted to pay homage to the original screenplay and to now take it to Broadway. And, you know, the whole idea of him playing Max Bialystock, because the idea that if he were to play Max, it would absolutely close the show is very funny. So, yeah, Larry pitched it to Mel, and Mel loved the idea. You know, they're a kindred spirit. You know, their comedy is alike in the sense of they both have great wit, and they're able to, and both very smart. So the banter is fantastic when they're together.
Okay, so here's a scene from the final episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm's fourth season. It's opening night of a new production of The Producers, starring Larry David. As the audience watches the show, Mel Brooks and Anne Bancroft sit in a nearby bar, confident that Larry David is bombing.
Did you see the look on their faces when Larry David forgot every line he... He went up in smoke.
Oh, God, I'm so glad. I'm so thankful. Thank God that this damn play is going to be over. We're going to get our lives back.
He has freed us from the anchor, from the albatross of the producers, which has invaded our lives every single minute, every hour of every day.
Trapping us.
No more openings in Cleveland. No more sleeping in dirty beds in Pittsburgh. We're free. Free at last.
I know.
Isn't it wonderful?
How did you know that he could ruin the show? How?
The minute I laid eyes on him, I said, this guy's a disaster. He's a living disaster. He's a storm. He's like a storm that will destroy everything in its path. I mean, he's got this gift. Everything he touches, he dooms. He's a little cyclone, a little tornado destroying the St. James Theater.
I know.
Any minute now, the show will be dead. Here, a toast to the death of the producers. May it rest in peace.
A scene from Curb Your Enthusiasm. We'll talk more with Susan Stroman, the producer and choreographer of the Broadway hit The Producers and the new movie adaptation, after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Susan Stroman. She directed and choreographed the Broadway hit The Producers and the new movie adaptation. If you don't mind my asking about this, I know you lost your husband, Michael Okrent, in the early stages of production of the Broadway version of The Producers. He was supposed to be the director, and you the choreographer, and you took over as the director. And then Mel Brooks lost his wife, Anne Bancroft, I think in the early stages of, or maybe later stages of the making of the new movie adaptation. So you were both in the position of making a comedy while you were in mourning for your spouse. Did he help you through that period in your life?
Oh, yes, absolutely. You know, I think The Producers has become a sort of a lifeboat for the both of us at two separate times, of course, but certainly we had just started working on it when Mike got sick and he passed away from leukemia. And I assumed I wouldn't work for a while. I couldn't really sort myself out. I was grieving so badly. And after Mike died, about 2 months later, there was a knock on the door, and it was Mel. But this time he wasn't singing. He sort of just pushed his way in and said, I have to do this. And he just really told me how it would save me to work on this comedy. And this time... you know, this hard, it's hard to say no to Mel. And but in fact, I really needed it. I really needed to keep going. And because it was a comedy, it really saved my spirit because I was grieving so badly. And now to think it happened to Mel when we started shooting. Anne got sick and she passed away during editing. And the same thing, he would be able to come to the set and it was like a little life raft. He would be able to laugh with the actors and laugh at the scenes and, you know, give me suggestions and before he had to go back to his wife. And it's very difficult to have someone, to watch someone who is ill and watch someone you love so much slip away. And the idea that it happened to both of us and the idea that the producers gave us some relief is pretty extraordinary.
Did you feel that you were able to do anything for him in the same way that he was able to help you, you know, through grieving for your husband?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I think because I have been through it, because he watched me go through it, he would come to me and we would talk about it, and I would know exactly what was going on. And 'cause he's very private, his personal life is very private, but at least he knew that he could talk to me about it and I would understand exactly what was going on and every step he was taking. So we've become very good buddies, you know. He's a wonderful, wonderful collaborator. But we were sort of like buddies, army buddies in the trenches during this whole process.
We know there were personal tragedies for you and Mel Brooks during the show and then the movie adaptation of The Producers. And then there was a national tragedy shortly after The Producers opened, which was September 11th. You opened, what, in the spring of 2001?
Yes.
And then
yes.
A few months later, it's September 11th, and, you know, Broadway is, you know, close enough to ground zero in New York. What did you think about the show going on afterwards, and when did you feel like it was appropriate for that?
Well, the thing is, it was a terrible time in New York. We were all grieving, you know. It was so different, because when you do lose someone, there's always some place to go for relief of your grief. But when those towers came down, there was no place to go. All of New York was grieving, and it was a very hard time. But a few days later, it seemed people started to go to the theater again to be together. And where they started to head was to the producers as almost relief. And the producers became not unlike a Fred and Ginger movie during the Depression. It was an escape. It was 2 hours of laughing. And in fact, we got more letters during that time how the show gave people a little relief than we've ever had any other time.
Well, Susan Stroman, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Susan Stroman choreographed and directed the Broadway hit The Producers and the new movie adaptation. It opens widely on Christmas Day. Here's Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick from the film's soundtrack.
It's often been said the theater is dead. The critics repeat it en masse. But the theater's alive. It's gonna survive, although it's a pain in the ass. You waited forever and finally got tickets to get to your seat. You gotta cross pickets. The guy to your right is frightfully tight. The guy to your left appears to have rickets. The music's yuck. The lyrics suck. The casting is all wrong. And when you reach the bathroom, the line is 5 miles long.
But still there's nothing like a show on Broadway. There's nothing like a Broadway show.
You swear you'll never go again. It's simply not worthwhile.
You make that vow and then somehow
you're back there on the aisle. That's why there's nothing like a show on Broadway.
There's nothing like a Broadway show.
Till you're in movies.
There's nothing like a Broadway show.
At $100 a throw, there's nothing like
Coming up, book critic Maureen Carrigan's 10 Best List. This is Fresh Air. Book critic Maureen Carrigan says it was a good year for the unexpected and the inspiring. Here's her list of the best books of 2005.
2005 was one of those unruly years in fiction, where I was disappointed by some authors whose novels I was eagerly awaiting, like Ian McEwan's Saturday and E.L. Doctorow's The March, and where other novels that I had to nudge myself to open turned out to be the tops. Mary Gateskill is a proponent of the everything is garbage school of writing, but the crucial difference between Gateskill and her cohorts is that she's not zeroing in on ugliness just for shock value. Rather, the literary stroll through slime is her route to the ineffable. Her novel Veronica is a charged story about the deep stupidity of youth that culminates in a measured and very moving moment of redemption. Nicole Krauss's splendid novel, The History of Love, doffs its hat to the great 19th century plot twisters like Dickens and Trollope in its interweaving of storylines across generations and continents. But the prevailing tone of Krauss's novel is up-to-the-minute edgy. Kazuo Ishiguro was the exception to my sense of being disappointed this year by big names in fiction. His odd novel, Never Let Me Go, was very affecting, evoking modern anxiety about scientific hubris and tying it to our most basic fears of extinction. A genre that specializes in investigating extinction is the murder mystery suspense novel, and several were exceptional this year. I really enjoyed Elizabeth Kostova's blockbuster The Historian, which joins The Da Vinci Code in the emerging Hidden Signs and Wonders subgenre of supernatural thriller literature. You may not have heard yet of Elizabeth Ironside. That's the pen name of Catherine Manning, the wife of the current British ambassador to the United States. Lest you might suspect that she's being treated with critical kid gloves because of that connection, let me assure you that Death in the Garden, the first novel of Ironside's to be published in this country, is the real deal. It's a classic English mystery that resurrects the upper crust world of tea and crumpet eaters between the wars, without making us readers feel as though we're strolling through a Disneyland simulacrum. Citizen Vince by Jess Walter is a screwball story about the lengths one ex-con in a witness protection program goes to exercise his right to vote. In its own coarse and very funny way, Citizen Vince is a testament to the American faith in the common man, as well as to the resilient possibilities of the crime novel. Nonfiction standouts this year were light on humor, with the exception of two memoirs, J.R. Moeringer's The Tender Bar, a wry and wisely class-conscious account of the author's boozy coming of age in a neighborhood saloon, and Deborah Larson's The Tulip and the Pope, a look back in longing and dismay at her years spent in a Catholic convent during the early 1960s. In The Year of Magical Thinking, Joan Didion's book about the death of her husband, John Gregory Dunn, and its aftermath, she observes that books about mourning constitute a literary category overrun with pat self-help tomes. But Didion's own memoir endows that neglected corner of the canon with an unsentimental intelligence. The Woman at the Washington Zoo is a posthumous collection of journalist Marjorie Williams' superb profiles and essays for Vanity Fair and The Washington Post. The collection, which is edited by William's husband, Timothy Noah, an editor at the online magazine Slate, contains a final section featuring William's own fierce reflections on her battle with liver cancer that claimed her life this year at the age of 47. Finally, two astonishing narrative histories came out this year. Adam Hochschild's Bury the Chains chronicles the 18th century citizens' movement to end slavery in the British Empire. More than an illumination of a forgotten episode, it's also an inspired account of the evolution of an emotion, empathy, among the British people. And Doris Kearns Goodwin's long-awaited 900-page doorstopper on Abraham Lincoln and his cabinet, called Team of Rivals, is just intellectually and emotionally stunning. Team of Rivals dramatizes Lincoln's almost superhuman ability to rise above personal insult, to assemble a group of former political competitors around him in his cabinet because, he recognized, the country needed their strengths more than he needed a chorus of yes men. As Hochschild and Goodwin respectively remind us, sometimes commonplace people can travel far beyond the boundaries of their own origins and upbringing. And every so often, a democratic nation can produce an extraordinary leader from the ranks of the ordinary.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University and is the author of Leave Me Alone, I'm Reading. Her list of the best books of 2005 can be found on our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm Terry Gross.
Who's got a beard that's long and white?
Who's got a beard that's long and white?
Who comes around on a special night?
That's white. Must be Santa. Must be Santa. Must be Santa. Santa Claus.
Who wears boots and a suit of red?
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. From the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide. On the web at fordfound.org. And from Universal Pictures, presenting Munich, directed by Steven Spielberg and starring Eric Bana, Daniel Craig, and Jeffrey Rush, in select cities December 23rd. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, A John Waters Christmas. We'll listen with the cult film director to his collection of catchy, sentimental, maudlin, funny, and ridiculous Christmas records. Also, we listen back to an interview with John Spencer. He played Leo McGarry on The West Wing. Spencer died last week of a heart attack at the age of 58. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.